history of the Oregon Health Plan and a perspective of the future of the Oregon Health Plan. And Barney Spate and Bob Dupree, could you come up together and we'll go ahead and get started. And to those, all of those people out there in the audience, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Barney Spate. I'm Director of Public Policy and Government Relations for Kaiser Permanente. But I think I'm appearing here today probably more in the role as one of the most senior healthcare lobbyists around, having worked for about 25 years in this vineyard, and also having spent 3 years in the Office of Health Plan Policy and Research from 1996 to 1999. What I would hope today to give you, and perhaps it will stimulate questions and answers, will be what I would call a fairly brief overview of the Oregon Health Plan, perhaps a Cliff Notes version of it. It's going to be more qualitative in nature than quantitative. I know that Mr. Dupree and others have lots of quantitative information that we can make available as questions deem that it appropriate. I do have a handout. In fact, I think I have two handouts, so I'm going to assume that everyone has it, and I'll speak from that. And I encourage that as we go through this, if you'd like to ask questions, I'm more than willing to take them as we go. What I was asked to do today was to talk a little bit looking back into the late 80s and early 90s of what was the goal of the Oregon Health Plan, what are the components of the Oregon Health Plan, what, from my personal opinion, has changed since the early 90s when we launched the Oregon Health Plan to 2003. Given where we find ourselves in 2003-2005, what kind of policy tools might we have available? The we meaning you as the Board of Directors of the State of Oregon, the legislature, we as many in this room and others as stakeholders to the Oregon Health Plan policy. And also a few comments about how do we frame a new consensus. The goals of the Oregon Health Plan are really contained fairly briefly in the ORS. ORS 414-018 states it is the intention of the Legislative Assembly to achieve the goals of universal access to an adequate level of high-quality health care at an affordable cost. And then further at 414-019, an iteration of that general statement, the goal of which is to assure Oregonians access to health care coverage. The environment in which we found ourselves in the mid to late 80s was in many ways similar to today's environment. And we were grappling with high levels of uninsurance, rapidly escalating health care costs, threats to employer-sponsored health insurance relative to affordability, and a growing number of uninsured. And clearly what we framed in the late 80s and 90s through a series of legislative initiatives, which I'll get to, was a pretty ambitious goal. And it was the goal of at the state level of providing universal access. We were not alone in attempting to pursue that goal. There were a number of states. In fact, there's been at least a couple of papers, I think, written on around the theme of the states who could not wait. That is, states that tried to, through a combination of federal waivers and other state programs, to move as aggressively as possible to get universal access for or near universal access for all of its citizens. I think one of the questions that we have to ask ourselves in 2003 that I've continually asked myself over the last couple of years is that goal or the premise of that goal still appropriate today? And if it's not, what should the goal be? And we can talk about that if you'd like. The next page of my handout shows some legislative findings, and I provided this as to let you get a sense of the context in which the legislature and the stakeholders were working in the late 80s, early 90s. Many of these statements, these findings, remain true. Some of them, perhaps, are open to question. The first bullet clearly remains true, and that is that there are significant public and private expenditures made in the healthcare sector. It's a significant line item of the state's budget. It's a significant, either in the Medicaid program or for state employees, it's a significant line item in most public organizations relative to health benefits for public employees, and of course the Medicaid and other health programs that the state sponsors make it a significant expenditure. Equally so in the employer sector. The legislative finding in ORS also states that the state has an interest in assisting Oregon businesses and individuals to obtain insurance or other coverage of necessary basic health care services. I think the principle or the attitude of that era is that the state should play an active role in both framing public policy and help framing private sector policy, or encouraging private sector policy to build on the public-private healthcare finance and delivery system that we have in this state and nation. There was also a finding that the lack of basic health care coverage is detrimental to the health of individuals, to the public welfare, and I've abbreviated this, and economic development. Subsumed or intertwined in this finding is really the concept of an interconnected system that we have, the public system and the private system in health care, both in financing and delivery, interdigitate. And what happens in one arena usually has some influence in another. And when I get into some of the environmental comparisons and contrasts, I'll make that perhaps clearer. And then, of course, the last finding, and I find this somewhat interesting, is that finding that the use of managed care systems has significant potential to reduce the growth of healthcare costs. This probably is the best giveaway of the date of these findings, in the sense that if you think back into the early 90s, and particularly 1993 and after, when it was clear that there would be no fundamental change at the national level in our approach to healthcare financing and delivery, and that managed care, both in the private sector and the public sector, Medicaid and Medicare, would in fact be a major strategic initiative and a major strategic tool for all of us to use. That fundamental premise, I think, is somewhat altered today. There are clearly learnings from that managed care era that we continue to carry forward, but I think managed care in 2003 is quite different than it was envisioned, or that it was in 1993, or envisioned to develop during that time. What is the Oregon Health Plan? When I previously had the good fortune to work with Bob and the staff at the Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research, I did a fair amount of public speaking, particularly outside the state, people asking what the Oregon Health Plan is all about. In many people's mind, the Oregon Health Plan is in fact the Medicaid waiver and the changes and the expansions to Medicaid. And I think probably in your mind, in the minds of most people in this building, because of the budgetary, fiscal, and policy impact, that's a quite natural conclusion. But there are really several components to the Oregon Health Plan that, when put together, were intended to strengthen the public-private partnership in healthcare finance and delivery, and really to try to build on and promote both employer-sponsored coverage, but also to clearly extend the role of state government beyond the classic Medicaid program for coverage for categoricals. What I've given you on page 5 are the official statutory definitions of the Oregon Health Plan. I believe the statute says that it's comprised of Senate Bill 5530 and 7 other pieces of legislation, and then it lays out what they are. And I will quickly kind of walk through these and note the time frame over which this has occurred, because it really began in 1987, and I don't believe there's been a session since 1987 that some aspect of the Oregon Health Plan, some component of the Oregon Health Plan, was either not being newly developed or refined, tinkered with, whatever. In 1987, House Bill 2594 created the Insurance Pool Governing Board, and I'm told that next week Rocky King will be here, and he can give you a much more in-depth perspective of the Insurance Pool Governing Board. But one of the major missions at that time, in a quick overview, was to try to make available to small business, and particularly small business that had not been in the group health insurance market, to provide an incentive for them to get into that market and to get their employees and the dependents of their employees covered. And so the Insurance Pool Governing Board worked with the health carrier industry and with various business associations under its statutory framework to develop new health plans, and I think at the height of its enrollment, some 35,000-40,000 individuals were enrolled through IPGB types of policies. 2 years later, 1989, it was really kind of the central bellwether year for the Oregon Health Plan historically, as we look back, with basically two major bills, Senate Bill 27 and Senate Bill 935, acting as kind of the public and private bookends, if you will, of the Oregon Health Plan. Senate Bill 27 really set into place the process with the Health Services Commission to develop the prioritized list, to set out a framework for seeking a Medicare waiver using the prioritized list and manage Medicaid, and began us down the road, particularly at the planning stages here in the state. We weren't quite ready to submit the waivers, but 27 really created the state statutory framework for that, the work to follow. Senate Bill 935 I wrote down as pay and play. Others will recall it as the employer mandate. It basically laid out, in my summary, would be that if you provided health insurance, then you weren't subject to a form of taxation that would go into a fund to help pay for coverage for working Oregonians without employer-based coverage. If you didn't provide coverage, then there would be a tax. Therefore, it's the pay or play. Clearly, Senate Bill 935, there was a reality about it that I think everyone realized, that it runs up against a federal problem of ERISA, and there would probably need to be there would need to be some sort of congressional action to approve this, or there would probably be a court challenge. Ultimately, 935 never came to be. There was no action by the federal government to give us a waiver for pay or play, and so the employer mandate side of the Oregon Health Plan faded away. But I want to talk a little bit more about some other aspects of the Oregon Health Plan that focused on the employer-sponsored and private insurance sector. The last piece of legislation in 1989 was Senate Bill 534, which created the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, OMIP. Again, Mr. King, when he appears before you, is a multifaceted administrator. He runs that program too. But the medical insurance pool is basically a high-risk pool that its intent was to make an option available to Oregonians who could not buy health insurance on the in the private individual market because of health status, pre-existing conditions, to allow them an option that if they had disposable income to buy an insurance policy, they could buy one. And the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool created that option. It created, I think it added a dimension of fairness to the individual, the private individual health insurance market in this state. And I look back with great pride and would point to both the OMIP board and to Rocky. I think Oregon has one of the most robust high-risk pools in the country relative to our size, in large part because of the, I think, leadership of the Oregon health care community through the funding that, that's provided to make OMIP work, and Rocky can get more into that. 1991, I remember, just for historical context, we launched the Oregon Health Plan in February of 1994. Is that right, Bob?
Yeah.
And so the waiver was submitted over, you know, in the 92-93 time frame. So we really haven't, in 1991, even gotten to the waiver yet. But we continue to put the pieces together. Senate Bill 44 was some more revisions and changes to the underlying Medicaid waiver framework, the Health Services Commission. And then two important pieces of legislation. Senate Bill 1076 was small group reform. And this was dealing primarily at looking at how does the private group insurance market work, particularly for small group, and what impediments to coverage, what industry practices need to be changed to make sure that that market works more fairly. And 1076 basically put in place a series of reforms, many of which were actually ahead of their time, because within 5 or 6 years, the federal government would pass legislation called HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accessibility Act, which basically put in place at a national level many of the concepts that we and a few other states were putting into place in the small group market, most notably guaranteed issue and guaranteed renewability. One of the problems that was cited in the national market, it did occur in Oregon, but it did not occur with the same degree of frequency, was that if a small to medium sized group had high health care costs in 1 year, a carrier could legally not renew them, or could actually not offer coverage at all, so they could say, we won't write you at all. The overall policy purpose of 1076 and the Oregon healthcare community and the Oregon health insurance industry played a major role in this, was to try to answer the question about how do we make the industry work more equitably for the purchaser of health insurance, but also be able to sustain itself as an industry, and to be able to serve the public into the future. And I think 1076 did a pretty good job at that. And in fact, there was some further tinkering in 1995, some more reforms that were put in place to 1076. Those are not officially part of the Oregon Health Plan, but I think the point I want to leave with you is that the Oregon Health Plan and those of us that were involved both publicly and privately, explicitly and implicitly, were really looking at both domains, the public domain and the private domain, understanding that both were interrelated. We needed each other. And I'll make a point in a minute when I get to the changed environment about how that has matured. The last piece of legislation in 1991 that is the official part of the Oregon Health Plan is the Health Resources Commission. At the time, its charter was to look at the issue of emerging health technologies, their impact on costs, quality of care, how they should be diffused into the healthcare system, and more recently, of course, in the last few years, the Health Resources Commission has taken on new charter, looking at the practitioner, I can't think of the name of it. The practitioner, it's the formulary.
Prescription drug plan.
The prescription drug formulary. But the background of the Health Resources Commission basically is to look at was charged to look at new technologies and how they could be used and to gather information and oftentimes make information available broadly to healthcare providers across the state. And then lastly, in 1993, the last official in the statute is Senate Bill 5530. This really contemplated the implementation of the Oregon Health Plan. The waivers were imminent, and it created the Office of Health Plan Policy and Research as an office that would play an oversight role of its implementation and attempt to play both an advisory role to the governor and to the and other agencies of the executive branch and to the legislative branch. There is I did not put this on here, but I hope that you'll make this note. There is one other critical component to the Oregon Health Plan that's not recognized in the statute, and that's the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, FEOP. FEOP was enacted in the 1997 session. If those of you may remember, in 1996 at the November general election, there was an increase in the tobacco tax approved by Oregonians to be dedicated to the Oregon Health Plan, and a good portion of that money was used in the development of the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, which basically provides, its purpose was to help eligible Oregonians who were not otherwise qualified for Medicaid or Medicare to be able to either enroll in group coverage if it's available and they can't afford the employee cost sharing, or to help them buy individual policy. So it was again somewhat ahead of its time in trying to, if you will, work up the income ladder to some of the problems that what I call working Oregonians have with making either group health insurance or individual health insurance work within their budgets. It's been a relatively small program in the sense of total numbers involved. Again, Mr. King can give you all of the details, but it's also been a model. It actually envisioned a lot of the what's been being talked about nationally and what some other states have done as far as helping promote both private sector group coverage and individual coverage where that's not available. I've probably missed some legislation along the line, but I think that you get a good sense that the Oregon Health Plan historically was conceived to be an expansion and reform of the Medicaid program with new tools like the prioritized list, but it also had a pretty heavy look at what was going on in the private sector. The next page, page 6, what's changed since 1994? Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me for interrupting. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Barney, it's my understanding that the 1993 legislation on the Oregon Health Plan, which established a health policy program along with it, was designed to close out the health policy situation of few years. I don't remember just exactly. Could you enlarge on that? And then I believe that was brought back in under a later.
The office itself. I'll have to. Bob can kick me if I'm wrong here. I was not active in the 1993 legislature as a lobbyist, but I know that the Office of Health Policy and Research was created in a bipartisan spirit as a tool that could stand outside the various agencies of government and be able to comment and assist and particularly provide commentary to the legislature about, is the implementation proceeding and is the Oregon Health Plan working the way we all intended it to work? We were supposed to be a partner agency to, for example, DHS, but we were also, I think, to play a role of being able to feel the ability within the administration and to the legislature to be able to critique what was occurring with the implementation. There was nothing in the statute per se that said the office would sunset. After the implementation of the Oregon Health Plan, really the office continued to play the primary policy role of how do we lower the number of uninsured, what innovations in the private sector need to be done and things like that. So it's been and continues to be a relatively small office. In that office is the Health Services Commission, the Oregon Health Council is staffed there, the Oregon Health Resources Commission is staffed there. It's a relatively, it's a small policy shop. I can't speak directly, were the prime movers of the 93 legislation, did they have it in mind that it would end, say, in 1999 or 2000? What's changed since 1994? I appreciate this opportunity because seldom does a lobbyist get to talk to an esteemed legislative committee and just give personal opinion. What you're about to hear is just my interpretation of what's changed. Again, it's qualitative. I think what I will tell you can be, if I say anything blatantly wrong, I hope my colleague, Mr. Dupree, will correct me, and I think we can get data to substantiate most of the interpretations that I make. Clearly, the first bullet is probably the most significant environmental change since 1994, and that is the state of the Oregon economy and the fiscal condition of the state are, if you will, 180 degrees from what we were living in and managing in the late 80s and early 90s. And I don't need to dwell a lot on that. We had a growing economy. Employment was high. Unemployment was very low, and employment was very high. It made the job market very tight. It's very interesting to try to just think back. It was only a few years ago where the recruitment and retention of folks, even in the service industry, was a major workforce problem. And insurance, health insurance, group health insurance was being offered in many service industry companies that had never done that before because of two reasons. One, to recruit and retain employees, and also because health insurance was relatively cheap in 1990, 91, 93, that time frame. Tax revenues were growing. And so I think there was a feeling that we could put new programs in place, and I will say the collective we, and that even and that we thought that they would be sustainable. And then I'll get into some of the premises of sustainability, but we didn't think a lot. I didn't think a lot, I will admit that, about if the seas get really rough, how sustainable are these programs. The second bullet.
Can I interrupt for just a second? Barney, I think it's important, having been through that and chaired the Appropriations Committee in 93 when we heard about the implementation of the Oregon Health Plan, we were assuming a number of things based on the framework of the Oregon Health Plan, which are different today. And that was this list that would slide up and down, basically, availability of resources. And I think that's an important part of what was assumed in the mind of the legislature at that time, because I remember specifically having conversations with the then Speaker Larry Campbell and others about what appeared to me to be a lack of clarity regarding the cash flow analysis of the money that was going into the program and how we were going to sustain this. But that was the one thing in the mind of legislators, is that in the event that we have limited resources, this line would go up.
That's correct.
And it's important to know that went away for the most part.
Well, and Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, let me take a quick jump there and point you to the fourth bullet, because I think I probably used a not very polite term or phrase, federal waiver politics, but this was really my way of encapsulating exactly what Senator Minnis was commenting on, and that is we thought we had the flexibility that in lean years that we could with a fair degree of rapidity move the line upward and therefore, if you will, trim benefits and still be able to serve people. And I think one of the frustrations that I know most all of us in the administration felt, regardless of the role, and I think many of you in the legislature felt, is that we couldn't deliver on that very effectively. And really, the waiver that came out of the last session was an attempt to begin to rectify that. But you're very right, Senator Minnis. I think the second to the end bullet, the role of managed care, was also the other implicit premise about how we would control costs, that we would have some externalities in the managed in an environment of managed care where the cost increases year over year. Excuse me. Both public sector and private sector would not be to their historical norm. That in fact, I don't think I ever said this, but I didn't say this, but I remember Margaret Heckler, who was the Secretary of HHS in the early 80s. This really precedes what went on in Oregon, was saying that we've broken the back of healthcare inflation. We didn't necessarily think that way, but we thought managed care would play a much bigger role of moderating cost increases in healthcare and bringing cost increases much more in line with the growth of the CPI, the growth of the Oregon economy, the wealth generating capacity of our society. Both of those were I think cost controlling assumptions that time proved to fool us to some degree. The second bullet is also, I think, the second most important phenomena of change in the last decade. The rate of increase of healthcare costs in the early 90s and into the mid 90s was actually historically awesome, in that it was so low. There were a couple of years where the medical CPI was equal to, or in some cases less than CPI, particularly at some regional levels. There were a couple of years there where businesses actually experienced premium reductions, and that we can get you charts that, and I've got a couple that follow that'll give you a picture of this, of we were in a trough, and so health insurance, group health insurance particularly, became much more affordable. Employers were very pleased because the annual increases were slow. And really, I think that translated into an environment in what the state could purchase through, again, on the public side, was in an environment of basically low cost increases. Employer-sponsored insurance grew in this environment when you combine it with the economy. In fact, I think one of the interesting factoids of the Oregon Health Plan is that as we eliminated uninsurance in the mid to late 90s, a substantial share of that fall of uninsurance was basically private sector driven. That is because of the expansion of workplace employer-sponsored insurance. The Oregon Health Plan, the expansion of the Medicaid portion, played an important role, particularly for the cohort of people who didn't have, either were not working or did not work and have insurance. But the real suppression of the uninsurance rate in the mid to late 90s was as much a function of the underlying economy and low health care costs as it was anything else. There are other phenomena that have clearly changed. I'm older and fatter, but I don't know if that's impacted the Oregon Health Plan. But I've tried to give you a sense that we find ourselves in a world quite different than when we put this together. We are in rough seas. We've been in rough seas. And last year, the last session's attempt to frame a new waiver for OHP standard to get benefits changed and reduced so that people continue to be covered, I think were all responses that we're attempting to deal with this changed environment. In a couple of minutes, I'll make some comments. It looks like some of the flexibility we sought then and got may in fact become new national policy, as the president has recently talked about giving states increased flexibility both in eligibility and benefits, and that may be a very hopeful policy tool that we have. There are two charts that I told you that this, my presentation would not be heavy on quantity, but the two charts that I've given you, the two graphs, the first one is in fact a great picture of my professional life, of what I've lived through, but it this was a one-page article in a national health journal called "The Sad History of Healthcare Cost Containment is Told in One Chart," and it basically shows the changes in private healthcare spending over about 40 years in this country. And you'll see the troughs are when healthcare spending, the annual increase of healthcare spending, was much more moderate. And then, of course, the peaks were where things were going out of control. Now, our current history is to the right. The history or the period of time that I'm talking about is really the trough, the managed care and the threat of healthcare reform running from the late 80s into the late 90s. But I would point out that the takeaway message in this is what we've been through and what we're going through, we've been through and in the past, and we probably will go through it again. It doesn't make the policy making any easier, but there's some comfort, I guess, that with the historical nature of typhoons, hurricanes, and nice weather. The other chart is a picture that just shows the relationship of the growth of health insurance premiums to really some of the underlying drivers of the economy, for example, workers' earnings or overall inflation. And again, note that the health insurance premium bar line is below those two other lines in the early and mid 90s, and we are clearly back to an environment that we were that's like in 1989. So with the one difference, and then 1989, I think the state economy and the state budget was quite different. Let me quickly conclude here with two other thoughts, two other pages here. I was asked to kind of comment on the tools that are available, and there are three levers. There are fundamentally three hydraulic valves in not only the Oregon Health Plan, but in any form of health sponsorship, whether it's public or private. And that's really eligibility. We've worked on, and we will continue to work on concepts of categorical, which is the federal required categories of citizens with coverage. And then a lot of the Oregon Health Plan, both public and private, has been looking at the non-categoricals. You expand the number of people, the coverage, costs go up. You contract the number of people that are covered, everything else being equal, costs go down. Covered benefits, though, that is, what's covered, what's not covered, what may be covered with limitations. As Senator Minnis pointed out, the coverage question was conceptually placed in the prioritized list. I think one of the questions this and perhaps other subsequent legislatures will ask is the prioritized list the tool that we want to use for making decisions about covered benefits? I would note, without trying to answer that question yes or no, that the fundamental concepts behind the prioritized list will work whether you have the prioritized list or not, and that is to look at what medical procedures and interventions work and what doesn't work or has less scientific evidence that works consistent, and pay for what works and don't pay for those things that don't work. Provider reimbursement rates. In Medicaid and in Medicare and in all other forms of healthcare finance, provider reimbursement rates are an important component of access to the system. We have been through in this state, in fact, when I began my career in healthcare 25 years ago, the policy of the state of Oregon was not to pay for the 19th or subsequent day of hospitalization. The Medicaid reimbursement had all sorts of ways to save money. And if you happen to be a Medicaid beneficiary and needed 19 days of hospitalization or 22 days, in the course of a 12-month period, the 19th, 20th, 21st were free by fiat. The state buys health care basically by setting the price it will pay. That's provides excellent budgetary control. The private system doesn't necessarily have to connect with that system. So provider reimbursements rates, I think, are important consideration, particularly access to professional services, doctors and other health professionals. Those are the three levers, the three tools, and there's lots of conversations that have gone on in this building and will continue to go on about where do we find the right balance given the fiscal reality. The last one is not so much a tool but an outcome and a strategy about how to manage, and that is the various delivery mechanisms that can be employed once the legislature decides how to align those three hydraulic levers. We currently use a system called the FCHPs. The acronym stands for Fully Capitated Health Plan. It's basically, think of it as a Medicaid HMO. It receives a fixed amount every month for the care of an enrolled population. And through the FCHPs, the state actually transfers the financial risk to this entity who's responsible for meeting contract terms and also staying within their budget. If they lose money, if they manage badly, they lose money, and if they manage well, they get to keep the difference. However we structure the program today and in the future, FCHP survivability is in part a function of how much gas do you have in the gas tank, and can they actually create networks of physicians and other healthcare providers out there that are more sustainable than the state can. They are in a weakened condition today. I don't think it's I think that's a not impolitic or misrepresentation of the reality. There are other models that we have now and have used in the past. Primary care case management is a way to complement the fee for service system. FFS on your handout is fee for service. Increasingly, because of the changes in Medicaid managed care, more of the Oregon Health Plan population is in fee-for-service. And I had to put down an old model from the past, the PCO, or the Physician Care Organization, which is a partial capitation approach. These are all of the tools that I think that are at our disposal. I think, in addition, what I didn't put down here, but more, I think it was on January 31st that Secretary Thompson announced an initiative for new flexibility, and I think for some new federal funding. I think the flexibility that I've read about relating to both mandatory populations and mandatory and optional populations, mandatory and optional services, is the kind of flexibility Oregon has been pleading for a number of years, and hopefully that will come along that gives us a little more flexibility. The details are yet to be, I have not seen them, but I think it follows a National Governors Association recommendation. Framing a new consensus, unlike the 80s, which was a politics of expansion, that we're going to deal with the politics of contraction. And the American political system, as I learned as a political science student a long, long time ago, does a real good job in the former and has a tough time with the latter. I think there's always been something different about how we in Oregon approach things, particularly Oregon healthcare, as health policy has been different. I believe we can have a civilized politics of contraction that's both humane and hard-headed simultaneously, but I remain kind of a naive, hopeful kind of guy. I think we have to start with a real frank understanding of the stark fiscal realities of 0305. That is, I know you as legislators and we on the stakeholder community side have to deal with this is the reality. This is how much there is. And then I think that leads into some very tough discussions about tough choices and tough priorities. And I wrote down here the concept that I continue to retreat to, and it's probably, it's not a retreat, it's probably just a returning to the wisdom of the past, and that is you have to triage vulnerabilities. We have to look at both economic, age, gender, and health status vulnerabilities and say, where do we put the state dollar? And if we don't have enough to address all of the vulnerabilities, then those with the highest vulnerability status become, I think, a priority for state government. I would also urge all of us to weigh all of what we do with a look to what do our choices, what are the ramifications of our choices on the private sector. As I said to you earlier, our system is interdigitated. The public-private healthcare sector, we don't live in two separate worlds. And whatever choices are made in this building for 03, 05 will probably have some impact on employer-sponsored insurance and probably some impact, maybe a great impact, on things like the safety net. And so I think we have to weigh the choices not only from the point of view of the populations we want to serve, our responsibility to the Oregon taxpayers, but also are there choices that mitigate the impact on the private sector or make it worse?
Barney, one of the things that we're struggling with as we speak today is how do we deal with populations within populations? Because I don't know that we have that flexibility. In other words, if we were to deal with the needs of certain medical needy, well, not all of them, there are some constraints, right?
Mr. Chairman, I believe there are. I mean, I'm not an expert in the area, but I think federal law, there are constraints within federal law. Hopefully, some of the things that I've talked about as far as flexibility would give us the ability to make priorities within priorities, if you will. But I think I know that the complexities are there that you're referring to. I would also note that we need to probably look back at some models that go back well before the Oregon Health Plan. When I got into this business, and again, I wouldn't consider myself at anywhere to be a Medicaid expert, but we had a general assistance program that was quite different than the general assistance program we have now, looking primarily at the intersection of low economic, high economic need and really health status problems, that is really critically or acutely ill. I think it's going to be a combination of both looking at for the new flexibility and also searching back for old models that might work. My final comment, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is I've given you a handout for no other reason than to make us all feel a little better. I wanted to let you know that we're not in this alone. This is a February 4th article out of the Seattle Post Intelligencer that gives, in my opinion, a really pretty good overview of what the state of Washington is confronting with its basic health plan and the approaches that Governor Locke has made in his budget regarding reducing the number of people with coverage, difficult, tough choice, expanding resources to the safety net to provide primary care access, and then the issues, it touches upon the issues of payment to providers and access to care. So I just wanted to let you know that our sister state to the north, who also had a major expansion program even before the Oregon Health Plan, is undergoing the same kind of dynamic. With that, I'll stop. I hope this has been helpful. I appreciate the opportunity, and I'll be around most of the session. So if you have a question about history, ask me.
Yeah, Senator Walker.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Spate, I've received a 6-page email from a trooper who just got laid off, and I normally don't read 6-page emails, and I normally don't read emails from people outside my district because I get hundreds of them from people in my district. But this one, I just got drawn into it, and I kept reading it and reading it. It was very passionate. And one of the things he talks about is the growth of the health plan and how it went from 3% to 10%. And then he talks about abuses that he sees in the health plan that almost all of the people that they bring in to arrest are people who are recipients of the health plan. He talks about people who come from other states across state lines, stay here for a couple of weeks and get services, expensive services. So my question to you is, there has been a tremendous growth in the health plan, and can we salvage it by going in and cleaning house, or do we have to really start over with a new system?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, many of the points that are made in that letter to you have been issues that have been before bodies in this building in the last 10 years. the issues of eligibility, of outstate use and misuse. I think we've done a lot. I think the administration, I think DHS and OMAP have done a lot to try to address some of those issues constructively. I think that here's a short answer to your question. I don't think there's enough savings in the fraud and abuse approach to make any kind of meaningful dent on, you know, the hole that has to be filled fiscally. I personally don't think that there is that much abuse, particularly on the interstate issues, but I think the ongoing questions of who's eligible and what are the criteria we use to judge eligibility is always a really tough issue to move from policy to reality. Most of the debates that I felt when I was an employee of state government and working with and close to the Oregon Health Plan, for the Oregon Health Plan, was continually going back to this question of who needs our help and how do we make sure we get the dollar to the right person or persons or family. And when you move from statute of broad eligibility categories and rules, I think there's always going to be some slippage there. Can it be tightened up? I think probably it can. Probably always can be. But clearly the growth of the Oregon Health Plan in its size of state government is very common to kind of what's just happened to state Medicaid programs. They've gotten bigger and bigger because of both the underlying cost of care, but also in many cases the underlying need of populations that are without health care. The fundamental strategic problem of health care in Oregon and in this nation is cost. How do we manage over a decade? We have yet to put a decade under our belt in this country or in this state where we have managed cost increases to align themselves with the general rate of inflation. And that's a tough problem for both you as state legislators who are minding the purse of the taxpayer and the employer individual who buys health care.
Senator Fisher.
A couple questions, Chair, with your permission. How much? There's obvious some problem. How much would it help if we had a mandatory reporting system on those issues where medical personnel, police personnel, people got a line on that? Because I have doctors telling me that people openly brag about it sitting in their offices. And it's not just one person. I mean, right, not just one instant. And then I talked to Jean Thorne just this morning, and she indicates that because of the audit that the Secretary of State's office just did, that they don't think that there's much of that going on. I happen to differ with that, because in looking at that audit, I'm not terribly certain that I put a whole lot of faith in the audit. But would that be a partial answer, at least getting a line on some of these people without the state having to go out and actually do all of the detective work on that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, I'm skeptical of mandatory reporting, but I think we ought to do everything possible, both with the general public, but more importantly, with those professionals, health or otherwise, that are closely involved with the populations, that if they think there's something that's being abused, a program that's being abused or a benefit being abused, I would hope they would make an inquiry, because I think where we all need to realize is that a dollar misspent over here is a dollar not available for somebody else who may be in need.
But what they're doing, they're responding to us rather than to the Oregon Health Plan.
Right. I mean, what they needed,
because they got absolutely no help from the health plan people in this process. And they also...
I would hope that would be otherwise, Mr. Chair.
Well, I would too, and we're in a new regime now, and hopefully that some of those things can be corrected. But they also, I get the feeling that they wonder, you know, here they performed a service, and they find out in the middle of a tonsillectomy, because somebody was talking on that, but in the middle of something that they're doing, then they report this person, are they going to get paid for what they've already done, or... you know, is it going to be dropped right there? They're going to have to send a person out with half the treatments and not the rest of them. But, you know, there's all right. kinds of problems involved here. But I was just curious as to whether you, you know, so that the state didn't have to provide personnel to go out and start ferreting these things out, if it would be a help to have a some type of a system that would ensure that they were reported and dealt with by the health plan people.
Again, I think that all of us who are involved in the healthcare system, if we see or believe that something like the system is being abused, I think we should report it, and I would hope that the state would have at least sufficient resources to be able to follow up and determine whether or not it's true or not.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
Barney, having been in the long-term care business at the time when. Basically, the Medicaid process was started, and the flat fee for service rather than the judging of everybody by their physical and so many points for this and so many points for that, getting different rates for all kinds of different clients. When that came into effect, there was also a decision made by the federal government that those flat fees would take care of everything that those people needed. There would be nothing else gotten on the side. And it was amazing how many state patients we got all of a sudden that had been private previous to that time. Apparently families had been helping take care of family members, as I believe we should do. At that time, it was determined then that the state paid the rate, and if they accepted this person, no longer could the family be attached to it. And so it seemed like there was a tremendous unloading of family responsibility at that point in time. Now, you mentioned something about it. Would you say you were a little naive, and was it positive or thinking or something like that to that effect? Using that, would you be naive enough to indicate whether the federal government is going to wise up one of these days and allow a little more help by families or other family members?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, I love to prognosticate, but the one thing I don't prognosticate on is the federal government. I do think, however, to end on somewhat of a positive note to our friends in Washington D.C. and elsewhere, is that I think we are learning. It's taken us a long time to learn about, particularly the social situation, the family situation, in which healthcare is delivered and successfully used. And there's a growing body of literature that you would say you've learned 40 years ago, and that is a family or whatever the social support system is very important to the healing process. And in many cases, I think the social situation is equal to or more important than actually the healthcare delivery. I certainly learned that when I was with the office in the area of mental health, where the role of housing to mental health treatment, successful mental health treatment, is an important resource. So all of those play a role. I think we're trying to break the silos down across that, but I think, you know, your point's well taken about how long it's taken us to learn that.
Mr. Chair, just one comment. Barney's response reminded me of the guy that said he knew every language but Greek. So when he was asked to speak Chinese, he said, "That's Greek to me."
Very good. thank you. I think that issue that you raised. Oh,
when you're done.
Go ahead.
When you're done.
Okay. Well, I'm done. Go ahead.
Barney, I've been listening to the questions, and I too get emails from state troopers and so on and so forth. And sometimes I'm nagged by the feeling that Senator Fisher just expressed, that maybe there was an unloading of family responsibility due to the possibilities that were created by the Oregon Health Plan. I'm also convinced you could spend more money chasing fraud and abuse. You know, the state could spend more than it would ever recover, and in fact, there's fraud and abuse everywhere. And so rather than trying to spend my time pointing my finger at who or what's being done wrong, I'd like to try and solve the problem. In that context, I remember in 93 and again in 95 and in 97, every session we started by saying, man, this is the worst budget. Have any of us been in a situation where we started a session saying, man, the budget's better off this time than it was the last time? Every time, in my experience, since 93, we've always started the session, this is the worst budget we've ever had. And yet if we look back at, for instance, 95, by comparison to now, we were rolling the money. We just didn't know it. Okay?
It's all relative.
It is. Now, given that every year we've kind of started off feeling that was the worst ever, does that have any, I mean, you know, what's changed since 94? I mean, you pose that question. Well, not maybe as much has changed as we think, because the perception has always been that it's incredibly bad and going to be incredibly difficult to do. This is a convoluted way of coming to a positive point. We've always thought it was bad, so why not go do it now? You know what I'm saying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I think I know what you're saying, and I guess one of my responses, not to be taken too flippantly, is it's really bad.
I know.
The gap.
I mean, it really is.
No, but the gap, the reality gap, and I've spent, I think many of us have spent 6 months looking, watching both the slow evolution of the 2001-03 budget and the preparation of the 2003-05 budget, and just the magnitude of the resource gap in the health plan is such that I simply personally don't believe, and others that are smarter than me can probably might be able to prove me wrong, I don't believe we can keep what we've got just by trimming benefits, because the gap is so huge. And therefore, I think we are at a place, somebody asked me, is it broken? I think it is broken, and I think the nature of this reality forces us to go back to some real fundamentals, and test ourselves on some of the premise questions. Are the premises still true?
See, that's very helpful, if I can follow up, Barney, because even though we may have thought it was broken before, it really is now, is what you're saying. And so you really got to begin to rethink all your premises.
At one point the boy in the woods saw a wolf.
So we can go back to the poor farm and start from there.
Well, I think there will be...
turn it over to John. John, Senator Menes has a question.
Well, I'm just going to repeat what I said kind of the other day in this committee. To a large degree, the problem really lies with us. I mean, there are a lot of things going on in the economic climate around the country, and there's been a huge transition in terms of health care policy, which is why this committee exists, is to try to understand trends. That was the original question I wanted to ask Mr. Spate, maybe to bring back at some point, is what are the future trends in health care that we're seeing? What are the professionals out there thinking now is the best way to go? Because back in 93, we were saying, you know, we wanted managed care. We were going to try to get primary physicians trained. We weren't going to steer physicians to specialty training. We're going to get access to specialists through technology in rural Oregon and these kind of things, but it seems like that entire landscape has really changed. But I want to get back to kind of the politics of where we are. Senator Shield is absolutely right. Every budget that we face has always been bad. Well, bad for what reason? Now, I would submit to you, even the budget we're looking at right now, according to the governor's submitted budget, is 14% above the close of session, last session. Now, I want to know where the money is going, because I think it's a relatively simple question, and we ought to be able to answer those questions at some point. I don't know that 14% is acceptable when inflation's, you know, 2%. But maybe it may not be. And I would submit to you that as policymakers, we've kind of believed a deception if I can be so bold as to say this, because the education community will go completely nuts. When, again, it's true that we spend almost $2,000 per child more than Washington and California on K through 12 education, and we're short-sheeting people in human services, there's a problem. And I think this legislature is going to have to confront some of those issues. Now, it may very well be possible that spending $2,000 more per child is appropriate, and that's exactly what we should be doing, but we should know why we're doing it. And I would submit to you, we don't. And I would also submit that human resource programs where individuals are literally going to lose their ability to survive supersedes, in my opinion, the education question. So I do want to know more. And I think that's really the vision of this committee, hopefully, is to look at health care policy trends and I think bring health care issues to a higher level of cognizance among members, because I think we need to recommit ourselves, if you will, to human resource questions because as our economy larger and there becomes a larger gap between those haves and those have-nots, as in our economy changes to service-related jobs, these questions are going to continue to plague us. And the legislature, as a governing body, I think needs to commit itself to the central purpose of government, and that's the protection of its citizens, either in terms of public safety or human resource questions. So I know I probably get shot in the back by an education advocate, but there you go.
We from Human Resources, Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, will be there to give you solace.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now,
but the health plan won't be available.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, we're going to move ahead. Bob DeCreed, would you like to? And then we do have Representative Westland scheduled. For what time is left?
Very well.
Hopefully there will be 15 points. Okay.
I'm sure there will, Mr. Chair. I can be quite brief. Okay. Barney has covered, for the record, my name is Bob DeCreed. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. Barney's covered very effectively a lot of what I had to say, the most important points, so I can be quite brief. The first thing I wanted to note, and this is from a long document, relatively long, that I used in making a presentation to Representative Westland's committee. One of the things that's new is that healthcare spending is going up dramatically at the same time that the general rate of inflation is quite low. And what this points out is that we have a gap of the kind that Barney just referred to between the demands of paying for the healthcare that we would like to provide and the resources available to do it that affects not just the state and other government purchases of healthcare, but also employers who are finding it increasingly difficult to continue to make the kind of contribution they'd like to cover their employees and their employees' families. Now, this is something new. In 2001, nationally, healthcare spending grew by 10%, and it reached 14% of gross domestic product. That's up from about 13% 1 year earlier. And going from 12% to 13% nationally, it required just about a decade to make that 1% of GDP increase. We made the next 1% GDP increase in 1 year. So we are in an unusual period of rate of growth in expenditures for healthcare.
Well, you clarified that then, because inflation in general is not going up, but certain aspects are going up tremendously, and those are the ones that we're dealing with right now.
That's right, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Very briefly, it's the medical rate of inflation is higher than the general rate of inflation, but the other contributing factors are increased utilization, new technologies that are quite expensive.
Right.
So there's a lot that goes into the increase in expenditures.
Go back to this graph that Barney provided for us. I mean, if what you're saying is true, where we're topped out and spending at 8.1 at the end of the graph, and this is 2001, you're basically suggesting that it's going to continue through the roof. I mean, it's going to go much, much higher than has been historically true.
Senator Minnis, is that 8% of GDP, or is that an 8% annual growth rate?
Yeah.
That what we've seen then for 2001 is a 10%. So I think what that says is that it's a little bit higher than it was on this graph. But
okay.
About in line with that, still quite steep.
Okay, but would it be? I mean, again, I'm a gumshoe policeman. You get up here, you know, at about 10%, and if I'm looking at the historical trends, it drops. And it looks to me, based on where we've been in the past, that it's about ready to drop.
But 100 minutes, that would be wonderful.
But I guess the question I'm asking, because I've asked this of Paul Warner, he's an economist, but there are medical economists out there. There are healthcare economists who, I assume, can explain things like this and what these glitches are. But do we have access to anybody that can do that, or are you that person?
No, Mr. Chairman, I am not.
You are on water.
I would offer one comment, is that each of the times where we've seen the graph change, there's usually been some intervention, oftentimes from public policy, that causes that change. The voluntary effort was basically a period of time in which the industry itself, under the threat of active national supervision, was probably, of all of those, the one that was the most market-driven, and of course managed care. But usually it's like the Rube Goldberg drawing or the scientist drawing, is here a miracle happens at this point. But I'll get you the names of some healthcare economists that...
Maybe the better question, Mr. Chairman, is what are those threatened interventions or public policy questions that are out there that will drive the healthcare cost inflation figures back down again? Because did these happen by accident or by design?
Senator Menes, Mr. Chair, I don't think anyone has a final answer to that, but I think there are some emerging cost drivers we can identify that play a role in that.
Mr. Chairman, this health care commission and the group, I guess that's one of the things, when I first went to a health care policy conference in New Orleans, I was surprised at were the number of legislators across the country who have no clue. And there seems not to be a resident knowledge of this whole subject matter. Do we have any group in state government or a private sector that really has a handle on where we're going with this stuff? In other words, I want to walk down and ask about the economy, where I think Oregon's economy is going. I can talk to Paul Warner. I can talk to the state economist. I can talk to the economist at U.S. Bank. They can give me some fairly reasonable answers. But on healthcare, it seems like we don't have a clue.
I think it's the nature of the beast.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menes, I think within the Oregon domain, both the Oregon Health and Science University has got a department that I think has got some expertise in this area. Oregon State University has a health administration, some faculty in health administration. I think there's some other resources across the spectrum of concepts, ideological or that can give you or the committee some more context, professional context, about both what are these trends mean and what are the implications for the future and what may, there are forces out there that are beginning that are at work in our marketplace that will tend to mitigate some of these trends, and the market is responding. But I think one of the questions that would be valuable for this committee to understand is not only what those are in the private sector, but what are their implications to the public sector, and then are there similar kinds of tools in the public sector? Because one of the thorny issues of the clients or the beneficiaries of state health programs is, by their very definition, they have limited disposable resources. And so how you structure market programs that can be responsive to their needs and fair is always kind of a problem that I think we have to confront. That doesn't mean it can't be done. It just means we have to be careful in how we do it.
Senator Menes, Mr. Chair, I think some of the factors we can identify have to do with changes in technology, which are expensive but effective, and which people expect to have if they need them. We've also seen a shift, to some extent, away from the kind of cost containment that managed care was doing a lot of as recently as 4 or 5 years ago. And I think this is having an effect on increases in expenditures.
Bob, are you addressing something?
I'm sorry.
Particular?
Yes, I'm on page 24 of the document that I distributed. My apologies, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Because of new technologies, which are quite expensive, because we're not doing as much as effectively to manage care as we have in the past, and because of factors such as direct-to-consumer advertising, which also increases demand and utilization. What we see is not only an increase in the underlying medical rate of inflation, but also increased utilization that compounds the problem. Now, based on this, I've done some prognosticating about what we're likely to see in the way of stakeholder responses, and I want to just cover these briefly. Employers, especially small employers, are increasingly asking employees to share in the cost of health coverage, both regarding premiums and copayments. They are beginning to reduce benefits, not too much so far, but I think that's going to be, in many cases, the next step. Employers are also deciding not to offer coverage in some cases where they have been considering it because the cost is simply prohibitive. And in other cases, employers are finding that they can no longer offer health coverage to perhaps not the employee but dependents, spouse, and children.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I want to hold off here and just go right back to page 24 because here's emerging cost numbers that totally don't acknowledge any cost to government requirements, government regulations, demands for perfection, and all this kind of thing that to me are huge cost drivers, well over above a lot of the things that are mentioned here.
Senator Fisher, Mr. Chair, are you referring to administrative burdens placed on employers? Or?
No, I'm talking about government regulations and what they cost, what people have to go through to get anything qualified by the government's permits, you name it. These things are huge, huge issues. You take just the difference in the rules and regulations, for instance, in long-term care. You got AIDS instead of now. Not only are they trained by regulation, so you have to go through schooling, but then they become half-time paper pushers, just working to cover your rear ends on rules and regulations and stuff that are caused that actually don't contribute one bit to patient care. But they take time, and they're all regulated by government agencies, demanded by government agencies, and you've totally ignored. That is a cost driver.
Senator Fisher, I think you raise a valid point, but I've not seen that that cited as a major cost driver, but I will look into that.
Well, I can tell you that the providers sure have seen that as a cost driver.
Okay. One of the things that we found on our tour of the rural health care facilities was the coding and reporting, and of course they're federal, many of them, some state, but I've added that to the list. Okay, go ahead.
I think we're going to see employees responding in ways that parallel the responses of employers. I think employees are going to find it necessary in some cases to turn down health insurance that is offered, not because they don't want it, but because there may be increased premium sharing required.
I think
they simply don't feel
we've already found that this year with state employees. Many of them have turned that down. Yeah.
I also think, Mr. Chair, when you hear from Rocky King about our experiences with the FEOP program, that will also be something that he'll go into in greater detail.
Okay.
There's also an increase in the pressure on the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which Mr. Spate was speaking about. As people lose insurance and then want to regain it if they become ill, very often they'll seek coverage through the OMIP high-risk pool. And this means increased enrollment there, which also means increases in the assessments on insurance premiums which fund that program. States, not just Oregon but across the country, are finding it necessary to look at ways they can reduce Medicaid expenditures, and that means looking at reducing benefits, increasing Medicaid cost share, limiting eligibility, and reducing payments to providers. Mr. Spate wisely said he doesn't prognosticate about the federal government. I shouldn't either. But I think that we are seeing some increased flexibility on waivers because of the case that states are making that they simply can't, within budget constraints, continue to provide Medicaid coverage as they have in the past.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I want to just kind of go back to the health insurance issue offered by employers or others.
Yes.
To what degree do mandates that we've put as legislatures on insurance companies, is that a cost factor in terms of the cost of the insurance package that an employer might be able to offer?
Senator Menace, Mr. Chair, I'll defer to Mr. Spate if he'll take a crack at that one. I think he has better knowledge on that than I have.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menace, I would respond, yes, they are costs. In many cases, the mandates that are on the books regarding, for example, certain services, we would probably say now in the health insurance industry, we will cover them anyway. Many of those mandates go back many, many years, but there's increasingly concern about as employers try to structure their health insurance packages to meet the balance, the needs of their employees relative to their own resources. State mandates are becoming increasingly, in the minds of many, I know that people will disagree with this, but intrusive. And it's one of the reasons that larger employers, for example, of over 250 and more, increasingly look at self-insurance, where they avoid state insurance regulations, are protected under the federal ERISA provisions, and therefore can then shape their benefit packages free of the mandates. It's an option that small employers don't have, and we're a small employer state.
Thank you.
Another response from the federal government worth noting is reductions in Medicare payments to providers. This, of course, has an effect in Oregon because it means that providers are not getting what they need from the Medicare payments and need to make up for that elsewhere. Managed care plans are offering less restrictive managed care products, and they're taking steps to protect their financial viability in a market where it's becoming increasingly difficult for them to contain costs the way that they're used to by controlling the utilization of care. Now, what might the future hold? Very briefly, I think we're going to see increased attention to the same three questions that Mr. Spate referred to. I'm on page 30 now, by the way. What benefits should be covered? Who should be eligible? How should payment levels be determined? I also think that purchasers, and this includes employers, employees, government, individuals, everyone who purchases health care and health coverage, are going to be unable to meet the pressure of double-digit rate increases in the premiums for health insurance if they continue, and if the rate of growth in the general economy remains flat. The pressure is intense, and if it continues, it's going to be unsustainable. I think that benefits, we're going to have to place a higher priority on identifying what works, what the outcomes are, and this gets back to something that Mr. Spate said about the prioritized list. The value is not so much in the list itself as it is in the principles that led to the setting of the priorities. One of those was that it is very important to get people in for basic, effective primary care. It's important to make sure they get an early diagnosis of a condition so you can begin treating it when it's still cost-effective to do so. And I think we'll be coming to that, back to that point increasingly. In terms of the programs that we have operating in Oregon, I think we're going to have to continue to pay close attention to the connection between FEOP and the programs operated by OMAP in the traditional Medicaid and SHIP arena. As Barney said, we don't want to do anything that will make it more difficult for employers to offer coverage to their employees and the employees' families, or more difficult for employees to accept that coverage. I think it's going to be critical as we adjust the Oregon Health Plan, restructure it, that we keep in mind that for some people, by far the best option is a subsidy that they can use to purchase private health insurance. For others, that option is not going to be the best. There will be individuals who are not offered employer-sponsored insurance at all, or who have chronic conditions which may be better treated outside the context of private health insurance because of ongoing needs for very intensive care. So I think we're going to have to be careful to maintain a balance between those two programs. And in the interest of time constraints, Mr. Chair, I think I'll stop there. I'll be that brief.
Could you explain what you just said, your last paragraph, about persons with chronic illness and doing treating those persons in a different form?
Yes, Senator Minnis, we have a number of people who are currently under coverage with the Medicaid program through OMAP who are very, very low income and who have chronic conditions, either related to mental health or physical health, which require intensive ongoing treatment, and they may not be very good candidates for coverage in the private sector because of that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Senator Shields.
I know this will sound like a question out of left field, but I have heard it stated that, and given everything you've said, you and Barney both, I've heard it stated that if we had, for instance, 10 years ago, gone to a plan like the Canadian Health Plan, we might actually be paying less of our gross national product on health care than we are today. Is that true or false, or how would you react to a statement like that? Because I've heard that statement thrown around a few times.
That's a very complicated question, Senator Shields. I'll do my best to give you a partial answer at least. I think Canada has the second highest percentage of GDP going to health care. We're at about 14 now. I think they are at about 10 or 11%. So I'm not sure how much better off we would be. They're also seeing some increases.
Well, maybe not the Canadian plan. I don't know that much about that plan, but just the concept of universal maybe.
Senator Shields, Mr. Chair, I guess the only answer I can give to that question is that I do believe that there are cost savings to be gained from having access to basic effective health care for everyone. And to the extent a national health plan makes it certain that everyone's going to have access to the most effective kinds of care, I'm sure that we can avoid some hospital admissions that don't need to happen, for example. And there will be savings associated with that. I also think the savings you'd see from having participation in basic effective health care by everyone might not show up immediately. You might see them increasingly after 3 or 5 or 10 years as the effectiveness of care and early diagnosis and early treatment became evident.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for being
here.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We may invite you back. Representative Westland, if you could come up, please. We understand that you have a committee meeting at 3 that you're chairing, so hopefully you can leave time to get to the next meeting.
I do indeed have a committee at 3, so I'd be happy to come back, too, if we don't get all the way through this. For the record, Representative Ben Westland, House District 53, here at the invitation of your committee, and I'm happy to be here.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like, if it's all right with you, and I think this fits the nature of the invitation, talk about 4 things today. First, just a brief overview, definition of the nature of the problem that we all face. Second, what the House Audit and Human Service Budget Reform Committee is all about. Third, what we've done so far. And fourth, how I see all of us fitting together in this whole thing working. So, please, Mr. Chair. First of all, nature of the problem. You go back to the governor's recommended budget, and in there, he outlines or appropriates approximately it's either $948 million or $946 million. Easy figure, and call it $950 million. That seems like a significant increase over the $600 million worth of general fund we budgeted in the last biennium, and indeed it is. But to meet the requirements of the waiver we've just been granted, which is one of the conditions is to increase eligibility under OHP2, the assumption he had to make was that there was no additional reimbursement rate and that not one soul would darken the door, additional soul would darken the door of a hospital emergency room or a physician. So no reimbursement rate increase, no increased caseload. That's how we budgeted. So with that in...
Go ahead.
Ben, I'm thinking back 2519, the legislation we passed the last session to deal with and the acceptance of the new waiver. Now, you're talking about an additional $350 million in this program. We were under the assumption that we were going to find those savings within the existing program. Well, so what happened to that little discussion?
Well, the CSL roll-up on that program, it doubled from 600 to a billion two. So you can...
Based on what?
Well, it's just a number I got from Mr. Britton in LFO. So I think that's a more in-depth question for... ways and means process, and indeed our process. I think that's something we need to look at. But those are the assumptions that were in the governor's budget. So, you look at that, and I mean, that's part of the nature. I don't think any of that is feasible or realistic. I did some back of the envelope, and this is literally back of the envelope stuff, taking what I perceive to be going through some of the budget reports of the basic Medicaid federal minimums requirements. I mean, that's long-term care, low-income children, seniors, disabled, blind. Drove that by 13% caseload, medical inflation, which may be too low, and came up with $850 million. This is, again, take this, please understand that I'm saying this as a back of the Ben Westland envelope numbers, so I'm not putting this into the record as gospel truth. But I'll bet you I'm pretty close. I don't think the basic Medicaid federal minimum package, which does not include pharmaceuticals, would be something that's acceptable either to this building or, more importantly, to the state of Oregon. If we don't succeed in all of our committees, that would be the cost of our failure. That's what we would not, I think, find tolerable. And that, I think, is our great motivation. And when I say we and our committees, I mean just that. The four substantive committees that are working on this issue, and obviously the Ways and Means Subcommittee. That's what I think the nature of the problem is.
Okay.
With regard to what the House Audit and Human Services Budget Reform Committee is all about, let me read, if I can, a statement. I want to get it just right, so I will read it. But the statement that I put into the record as to what our committee, its function was when we were... So if I may, Mr. Chair. First of all, let me tell you what this committee is not. It is not, as a recent headline in my very own local paper proclaimed, the committee that is gunning for the Oregon Health Plan. And if you read in a few paragraphs, that I have been anointed as the hired hitman. That's not what this committee is all about.
Sounds like it.
I would have understood it if our iteration of the Willamette Week, the source, would have said something like that, Senator. But no, it was indeed our beloved Ben Bulletin.
The criminal target, or something?
So I hope you're watching, James. To the contrary, the purpose of this committee is to continue to refine the process that was begun last year under the leadership of Representative Cruz, Winters, Bates, among others, to begin to assess the status of where we are in regard to the Oregon Health Plan under our current budgeting limitations. The purpose of this committee is to primarily ensure that the most vulnerable Oregonians, low-income children, seniors, people with disability, the chronically ill, and those with substance dependence and the mentally ill continue to have access to the best quality health care available. We have been afforded, and this is a rare privilege and opportunity, the ability to combine a substantive and budgeting process committee into one committee with two primary purposes, that of lowering health care costs for all Oregonians and in the process to save the Oregon Health Plan. If you are sitting here as a committee member, it is not by accident. You have the knowledge, experience, dedication, and perhaps most importantly, and I hope this speaks to all of us, the creativity necessary to meet the challenge and this responsibility. To begin, we will take the health services cluster, as it is called, the DHS reorg, which obviously includes OMAP, mental health, A&D, and to a lesser extent, and I don't think we're going to, at least not, I'm going to concern myself too much with the public health segment. I had to say that for Katie. We will examine primarily OMAP for first the OMAP delivery system with special attention to the demands that it places on the state budget. This will not be a bill-driven committee. So if any of the members on my committee have human service interests that are necessary, that they're necessarily interested in, send them all to Jeff Cruz's committee. If you are a member sitting on this committee and expecting a bill with human service relating clauses to come here, you might want to talk to Jeff Cruz. Again, we're not going to be a bill-driven committee at all. We are not going to tweak around the edges or finesse the margins. We will have the luxury of spending time, contemplative, deliberative time on how to refine, improve, and if need be, substantially change the way Oregon delivers health care services, particularly as it relates to the health services of OMAP, MH, and AD. At the end of the day, we will make a recommendation as to whether to modify our existing waiver or make application for a whole new waiver. In other words, we will construct, this committee will construct, the best delivery system possible within the fiscal limits we face today. We must work closely with all three other substantive chairs as well as with Chair Winters from the DHS Ways and Means Subcommittee. And when we are finished, this committee will make a delivery system and budget recommendation to the Ways and Means Subcommittee, of which, as you're probably aware, two members of this committee sit on that committee. I look forward to this challenge. It is going to be long. It is going to be arduous, but it must be done if we are going to stop the current system from imploding and going back to a basic Medicaid delivery system, which I don't think anyone on this committee wants and anyone sitting in the audience wants. That's the phrase or the substance of exactly what I read in the record defining what our committee is all about. Any questions on that? What we've done so far is we've heard testimony. And from three superlative witnesses, one of whom you had here today, Bob DePreet, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, and Rocky King, we have chided them in a complimentary way, saying they've established the DePreet, Goldberg, and King standard. I can't tell you and recommend highly enough to you that you get some input from those folks. Bob DePreet and Bruce Goldberg worked on the history of what the Oregon Health Plan is and the system, or lack thereof, of the Oregon healthcare delivery system. It is a very much a patchwork quilt, something we have always reacted to in creating our policy, knee-jerk reactions, and we really don't have the system that we think we do. Excellent testimony. Rocky King came and talked primarily about the commercial markets and FEOP. The book, and I brought this with me, that Rocky brought was, I mean, it goes through an incredible list of data specifics, trends regarding commercial markets, and in particular FEOP, and then his presentation in the back, which we spent about 4 days on, and I'll get you guys a copy of this. Again, talking and detailing trends. It really gave us a good platform, a good foundation from which to start making some of these decisions.
He'll be here on Thursday.
Have him do this for you. I mean, this book is a gold mine and a resource, as is the information that Bob and Bruce delivered. I mean, this is good stuff. That's the basic philosophy there. We are hearing today for the first time from OMAP. Gene is down. We look forward to that. Not so much the structure inside of OMAP, you know, what they do good, what they do bad, not that kind of thing at all. We're going to try to determine where OMAP falls over and influences adult family services, TANF, FANDI, you know, mental health, CHIPS, the whole thing, where it overlays out into the other parts of the DHS budget. I mean, that's what we're starting today. And then how I see this whole thing working, first of all, as I think most of you know, my vision or the vision for this unique opportunity, and again, I can't stress that enough. We've got the opportunity to finally do what we always say we want to do in Ways and Means, which is have policy drive budget, and regrettably, as we know, at the end of the day, budget driving policy. We've got the opportunity within the confines of available resources, and I want to stress that too, within the confines of available resources, to finally have policy drive budget, and that's what this committee is all about. As most of you know, originally I thought it'd be a great idea if this could be a joint committee. Powers that be deciding that was probably not feasible. And what has transpired since then is that given that, I've met, as they've met with me several times, all the Health and Human Service committees along with the DHS, and given that this committee, the Audit Committee for short, has a budget function. I met with the co-chairs who devised what I call a modular system. So, and here's where it really becomes the we. I mean, I don't care necessarily who does what, but there are many, 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 many pieces. And just as I was sitting in the chairs, I came up with, you know, pieces that go into, you know, creating the superstructure, kind of like a unibody car. You know, you don't necessarily just build a framework and hang stuff on it. The pieces become the structure, you know, of the car in this case, or in this case, the delivery system. We've got a lot of work to do. All of us have a lot of work to do. And like I said, just as I'm sitting back there, we've got to refine FEOP, residency requirements, benefits, eligibility, reimbursement rates, third-party payers, MSAs, mental health delivery, special subset of that could be mental health and justice system delivery, A&D delivery, OMAP operating efficiencies, managed care versus direct service or fee-for-service. I mean, are we really saving money with managed care? I don't know the answer to that question. But if we are, great. If we're not, we got to do something different. Mandatory co-pays, pharmacy AWPs, pharmaceutical costs, the list goes on and on and on and on. And so what I'm asking you guys to do, and I'll hand this out, maybe you want to see this, is figure out what areas you want to specialize in. We've all got more than enough work to do.
Okay, now we met this morning,
right,
and talked about a couple of areas. You suggested two areas, medical savings accounts and delivery systems. You read off about 12, and I know that the time is short. We have probably 5 to 6 weeks before we're supposed to kind of wrap up and get this to Ways and Means.
Thank you.
Well,
go ahead.
Okay. Well, what I'm saying is that we do need to continue to meet together. We need to refine what we're attempting to do and not try to do it all. Now, we do have bills in this committee. So I think what we need to decide is what we're going to concentrate our time on. What part of the big picture are we going to be working on? So why don't you go ahead and...
Yeah, and you brought up a very good point. This is not my admonition. This is the co-chair's admonition. I mean, they are doing the health services module in DHS starting March 10th. I pushed them a little bit to get to March 15th. So that's why I say there is a ton of stuff to do between now and then. And how I see it happening is working together, very much together, frequent chair meetings, however you want to do it, is all of the various Health and Human Services Committee designing these pieces, which in, you know, collaboration with all the committees, come to my committee, plugs into what's already been done, goes right from there. If I have a one-day work session and one bill, I'm a happy guy. And we send it down. We've been working with Jackie the whole time. You know, we send it down to Ways and Means, and she can then plug that finished product into the DHS budget. I mean, we have a very tall mountain to climb and a very short time to do it. Okay. So pick your poisons and let's go.
Good. Any questions or comments? Okay. Not seeing any questions or comments. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. This is important. And yeah. So, again.
Well, and after Thursday when Rocky King comes, that will help us a lot. And then we got to get together again and talk about it. And we'll be talking about it as a committee.
No.
In terms of what we will concentrate on.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Representative Westland, we work together as co-chairs of the Interim Audit Committee. And I would surmise, but I just want to verify for the record, that we will be expecting some work in your committee on the issues that we discussed in the audits of the Human Resources Department and stuff in there.
Yeah, and I'm hoping to be done, you know, where that doesn't relate to the health services piece. You know, I think we got to spend all our time on that. You know, if there's something that's timely, yeah, we'll do that fire. Again, that's got to be one of those little pieces, Senator, that plugs in there. After that, there's already a couple of audit bills running around that need to come to that committee. I mean, quite frankly, I see that as after March 15th. Yeah, you bet. And again, here we go again. I mean, this is what you and I were working for, trying to get this to be a standing committee. And we succeeded with your help, so thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Are you adjourned?
Oh, we are. Good. Okay, let's go over
Thank
here.
You.
Good to see you, Ben.